Hey church, welcome, 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 welcome. Glad that you're here. My name is Chris, lead pastor here at the church. We're continuing our series in Relatable, exploring God's good design for relationships. And so again, if you're new, if you're checking this out, you just clicked online and you are here, explore with us as we dig in again. So just real a few housekeeping items. Where are we going? So this weekend, last weekend was expressing love. This weekend is expressing anger. And so we're kind of looking at the series in couplets. So we're doing the communication stuff. Next week and the week after is we're talking about sex. The first week we're going to talk about the vision of sex and marriage. Then we're going to talk about the realities of sex and marriage. And so just FYI for you parents, that we're going to go there. We're going to be tasteful, of course, but we just want to set you up for success so that you are aware of what's going on. So there's that. The other thing is like what we're trying to do in these few weeks, last week and this week, is really set a vision for emotionally intelligent marriages, and how do you express love and to do that in an effective way, and how do you express anger and to do that in a constructive way. And so that's what we're trying to do here. Now, I realize as we're talking about this, maybe a fair critique of this series in general is, but I'm not married, and so why would you be talking for 12 weeks about, and so that's actually quite fair. I think what I would just remind us of is we did talk about singleness and celibacy and friendship in the family of God for the first 2 weeks. We really wanted to include those who aren't married and to address your world, your situation, your hurts, your hangups, all of that sort of stuff. So we did try. And I think what I would also say is I believe that these principles, especially these last few weeks of expressing love and expressing anger, this is so applicable for every single relationship that you're in. So keep that in mind. Translate this to you. I'll talk broadly and narrowly, broadly to everybody and narrowly to marriages as we go through. So thank you for your grace as we do that. You know, for those of you who have been married for any length of time, we kind of look back and see the beginning of our marriage is like the honeymoon, right? Oh, everything is great. The person looks good and smells good, and we just can't believe that they're ours. And this is the greatest. This person is the greatest gift I've ever had. And you know what? That all that stuff is good, and all that stuff is true. I don't want to be disparaging against that. But if you've been married for any length of time, you realize, wait a second, this person is imperfect, and there's a lot of anger and frustration and missed expectations, and the reality sets in that this person is very human. So there's a viral article in the New York Times in 2016. It was written by a guy named Alain de Botton. He's a French philosopher. He's not a Christian in any stretch of the imagination. The title of the article was Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person. I want to draw some truth out of what he said when it comes to this idea of anger and kind of the reality of marriage. He says, we need to swap the romantic view for a tragic and at times comedic awareness that every human being will frustrate, anger, annoy, madden, and disappoint us. He says, let's just give up this whole idea of Hollywood and let's just deal with fact here. Then he goes on, and we will, without any malice, do the same to them. So that person's going to annoy you, frustrate you, anger you, and you will do the same to them. He says, but none of this is unusual grounds for divorce. So he's like, you don't have to break up over it. Why? Because choosing who we commit ourselves to is merely a case of identifying which particular variety of suffering we would most like to sacrifice ourselves for. Oh, how romantic. Wow, that's beautiful. It's not beautiful. It's a little harsh, but I think he's on to something, that the reality of life together means that there's going to be anger and frustration and all of this stuff of communication difficulties around that. So here's what we're going to do this weekend as we think about expressing love. We're going to look at a command in Ephesians chapter 4, look at ways to do conflict and anger, destructive ways, how not to do it. And then we're going to come to the table, the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, towards reconciliation. So we got three kind of movements there in the last towards reconciliation. So let's start here. In Ephesians chapter 4, Ephesians, high point of the New Testament as far as theology and the effects of Jesus and what he's done. And so the first three chapters of Ephesians are belief. It's all about belief, Christian doctrine and ideas about who God is, the gospel, all that stuff. And then the last three chapters are about behavior. Belief leads into behavior. And so here's what Paul is doing in Ephesians 4, is he's talking about the difference that Jesus has made in your life. And so he talks about rules for Christian living in community. And here's what he says. He says, in your anger, do not sin. I want to unpack that in two ways, In your anger is the first one. In your anger. So for some of us, when we come to this conversation about expressing anger, I think the first step is to say, you have feelings of anger. Because depending on your family of origin, how you grew up, your view of conflict, your experience, all that sort of stuff. For some of us, we just want to shy away from anger or conflict all the time. And so in your marriage, you're like, oh, like, no, we don't have any conflict. Well, there is no feelings of anger. And I want to say that doesn't pass the smell test. It just doesn't work. When you get two people together, there's going to be feelings of frustration and disappointment and anger. It is normal. I think that's so important. It's normal in our anger, in relationships with all people and in our marriages, that there are feelings of anger. And so if you say, there is no anger, there is no conflict, we're good, it doesn't pass the smell test, here's a few things that could be up. Number one is maybe you just haven't been married long enough. You're still in the honeymoon where that person smells nice all the time and does their hair nice all the time. Maybe you just haven't been married long enough. Maybe you just don't know each other very well. Maybe you don't talk very much. Maybe that person's on the road. And so your marriage is fantastic because the person travels 340 days of the year. Maybe the other thing is that you're just lying. You're afraid of what that would mean. Maybe you've lost your personhood and the relationship doesn't mean a whole lot to you anymore. And so you're just backed away from any difficult conversation because you know what? It just doesn't matter. Well, all of those things aren't good reasons, aren't good signs in our relationships. And so I think for some people, the first step is to say, yes, there are feelings of anger here. Now, I was never good at math, all right? Never good, still not good. Like my daughter is now in grade 2, and this is still at the point where I can help her with her math, but I can see a time very, very soon where she's gonna come to me with a problem like this. A train left, you know, Philadelphia traveling at 80 kilometers an hour. Another train left New York at this time. When will they meet in Washington? Once those problems in math start, I'm like, I have no idea. All right, this is why we have Google Maps for those types of things. So I'm not good at math, but here's the one thing I know. Here's a math problem, is that one sinner plus one sinner does not equal no conflict. Like that is so clear. When you have one person who's a sinner, another person, it does not equal no conflict. And so we have to say, you know what, there is anger. And it's in your anger, do not sin. What is conflict? Well, conflict is, simply put, like a difference of opinion. So there's differences of opinion on all sorts of things, and those differences of opinion lead us to places of anger and frustration. So I want to talk a little bit about anger. I want to zoom in on anger, this feeling. In your anger, do not sin. Well, what is anger? You know, anger actually shows us a lot about what we hope for and what we dream about. Psychologists will say that anger is a second emotion. So we feel something first, and then we get angry. You don't just get angry out of nothing. It's a second emotion. So what I want to do is I want to lead you through some thinking from a 12th century Catholic saint. His name is Thomas Aquinas. He wrote the book, a huge tome of theology called the Summa Theologica, still a studied philosopher to this day. He's a saint in the Catholic Church. And in the Catholic tradition, in order to be a saint, you actually had to perform some sort of miracle. And for Aquinas, the reason why he was sainted was because his miracle was that he was so smart that it had to be divine how smart he was. So anyway, here's what Aquinas says about anger. I love this. He says, anger equals this. It's desire plus hope plus sorrow. Desire plus hope plus sorrow. So think about it this way. I have a desire that my kids sleep through the night. I have hope that tonight they will, because tomorrow I have a very busy day. They get up in the middle of the night and I get angry. I have hope, I have desire, and then there's boom, sorrow comes, all right? So hope plus desire plus sorrow. So this has been helpful for me as I get angry. And this has been helpful for me to kind of feel my thinkings and think my feelings, all right? And this has given me pause to say, well, what am I hoping for? What's my desire here? And what's the sorrow that I face? And so I've had to come to a place where I'm like, well, is it an actual legitimate hope that my kids who are young are going to sleep through the night every night. No, it's not. So that actually has helped me to think through the process of why and how I get angry. And Aquinas says, this shows us where we put our hope and our desires, because we are met with sorrow all the time, that anger equals desire plus hope plus sorrow. And so Paul is saying, in your anger, which is normal, it's a normal emotion, do not sin. To put that positively, in other words, it is possible that in your anger, you don't have to sin. Because if we're honest, replaying some of the tapes of our relationships or our marriage, some of the most difficult, regretful moments of our life have come when we were angry. When we said something, when we did something that we are ashamed of, that ruined a relationship, put a wedge between somebody that you love and you. And this is the hope, is that he's saying, in your anger, do not sin. In your anger, do not sin. See, the hope is that when we look at Jesus, you see somebody who, in his anger, did not sin. The one moment, we don't have time to get into it, but the one moment that comes to mind is when Jesus turns over the tables in the temple. He has righteous anger towards a place of worship being desecrated and basically turning into a commercial mall. And he says, this should not be. And so Jesus shows us how to steward this anger properly. In your anger, do not sin. Then it says, do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. This is kind of the second clause. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. Don't have time to get into it. What this is talking about is an immediacy. You need to deal with this anger. Unresolved anger is not good, and you need to deal with it. Now, some people will read this and say, do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. And so they're up till like 2 a.m. trying to keep their eyes open and trying to work through their conflict, their difference of opinion and their anger, because you cannot let the sun go down. We have to deal with this today. I don't read it that way. I think this is an idiom. It's a phrase. So when you hear the phrase, it's raining cats and dogs, you don't actually think it's actually raining cats and dogs. It's a phrase to mean something else. And what this is saying is, deal with your anger immediately. So if that works for you, and it's a 24-hour period, you don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, great for you. But I think what this is actually saying is, deal with it in a very urgent matter. Why? And do not give the devil a foothold. Unresolved anger, unresolved conflict leads to feelings of resentment and bitterness. When conflict, when differences of opinion, when frustration and anger and these feelings aren't addressed, when we get out the sweeper and we sweep it under the rug, we think it's dealt with, but it's not. And when truth is not involved in a relationship, it will inevitably go shallow because you're not working through these things. And so don't get the devil a foothold in your key relationships. Deal with it. That's what Paul is saying. Okay. Now, what I want to do is I want to lead you through some ways constructively that you can express your anger in the midst of conflict, all right? I offer these based on different thinkers that I've been reading and even in my own experience. The first one I want to lead you through is to fight as friends. This is really getting at, how are you viewing this other person? Are they an enemy or are they your friend? And so if this is your spouse and your marriage, are they your spouse, your partner for life, one whom you've covenanted with, or are they your enemy? If you think about this, maybe your neighbor or maybe your grandkid or your whoever that is, how do you view them? And so oftentimes, the first way that we think in conflict is that this is me right here, and this is the other person over there, and my job is to make them wrong, all right? So I lob verbal grenades, this person does the same, and this is how we view the conflict, all right? This is the dividing line. To fight as friends is to actually think differently about this. It's actually, this is the issue. There's nobody on that side. I'm here. This person is here, and instead of attacking each other, you work together as teammates on the same team. This is when you fight as friends. Are you enemies or are you friends? And so when you fight as friends, you approach conflict and anger and frustration differently. Because if this is you, you adopt a ministry mindset. When something comes up, you want to bring it up because you want to let them know the impact on you. that you want your relationship to get better. You want them and you to grow into Christ's likeness. That's what ministry mindset is. I want to bring this up so that we would be closer, that our marriage or this relationship would honor God, that we would live at peace with one another. So that's why I'm bringing this up. When you don't have a ministry mindset, you bring things up to pay them back, to prove that you're right, and to make them back away from their position. You want to let this person know how wrong they are and why. But in this way, you're saying, you know what? Here's why I think this matters and why we need to deal with it. When you fight as friends, you have to ask yourself, what is the goal of this communication that I have in this moment? The second way that you fight as friends is you make it safe for this person who you are in relationship with to criticize, to bring things up. If there is not a healthy environment to bring up anger, to bring up conflict, a relationship will get stale and shallow. So both people in that relationship need to make it safe in order to do so. Oftentimes in relationships, what ends up happening is an issue gets brought up. This needs to be talked about. And then the other person does two things. They either fight or they flight. They either get their boxing mitts on to go at it, or they put on wings and they want to fly away. And both are unhealthy if you want to do conflict and anger constructively. Because if there isn't a safe place to bring something up and the other person just says, oh, yeah, let's go. Well, man, nobody wants to bring something up. And so issues don't get addressed. But it's equally as damaging for the flight. When an issue gets brought up and the person says, I'm so sorry, I'm so wrong, I'm the worst person in the world. And they fly away from the problem, wanting to own it too quickly, maybe out of a sense of being more spiritual. Oh, I am so sorry, I'm the worst person in the world, you deserve better. Both fighting and flighting are not good, productive environments for conflict and anger to be worked through. And when you fight as friends, not as enemies, this is the environment that happens. So that's the first one. Second one is attack the problem, not the person. A problem is brought up, a situation, a difference of opinion, and it's you're thoughtless. How dare you? Those types of things. But that's attacking the person and not the problem. Attacking the problem says, hey, we have something here. There's a problem. Can we take this problem, put it on the table, and both try to solve it in order that our relationship would flourish? If all we do is attack the person, what ends up happening is we just level up the attack, right? We level up, oh yeah, well you did, well you don't know, and what about this? No, when we attack the problem and not the person, it creates a great way to do this. And so some of you need to pause this and screenshot this template, all right, as you're working through these situations. Here's how I think this can work. As I see it, you are doing this, fill in the blank. It is affecting me like this. I'm feeling nervous or unappreciated, right? I wish you would do this instead. Can you just say nicer things to me instead of being so critical right off the bat? I'd really appreciate just maybe some affirmation before the criticism, right? I wish you would do this, but I need to find out whether I'm missing something. Tell me, do I have this right or not? Do you hear that? It's way different than saying, you did, how dare you, you messed up again. And when you're attacking the problem, you're saying, here's the problem. Here's how I'm experiencing it. Here's how I think it should be solved. Am I getting that right? And you're inquisitive and curious and humble. And this is attacking the problem and not the person. Folks, if you were to start doing this in your key relationships and your marriage, man, things would be different. All right. Now, next, speak the truth in love. I need to zoom through this one. Sometimes when we get married, depending on your family of origin and that sort of stuff, it's like, oh, we don't want conflict. This is not good to have any sort of conflict. And so we need to be on the same page all the time. But you've forgotten that one of the purposes of marriage is that it would refine your character so that you would become more Christ-like. Jesus's ministry to us in John 1:14, he's full of grace and he's full of truth. And both matter. If all you have is grace in your marriage, if all you have is overwhelming, everything is positive all the time, sometimes truth is not involved and therefore no change happens in the other person. My friends, one of my key roles when I said yes to marrying Krista is to help her prepare to meet Jesus. So that when, at the end of Chris's life, long time from now, that when she sees Jesus, he says, I know you. You look like me. And Krista says to him, I know you. My job is to help Krista prepare to meet Jesus, which means that I need to be affirming and positive and see her flourish. But it also means that God has asked me to play a refining role in Krista's life, to give her observations, to help her understand the ways in which she is not formed in the image of Jesus. And she does the same to me. And we do that by speaking the truth in love. And there's lots of ways to do that and lots of bad ways to do it. In Ephesians 4:15, that's what Paul says, to speak the truth in love. And so what I would say is, I think there needs to be, in healthy relationships, in healthy marriages, there needs to be a refining of each other, not so that they would better serve me, but that they would better reflect who Jesus is. So how do you do conflict constructively? Is you speak the truth in love. Then, rules for a fair fight. So I want to jump through this. There needs to be rules of engagement. If you want to do conflict and anger and frustration constructively, there needs to be rules for a fair fight. So let me lead you through, all right? First, you need to identify the issue. What are we talking about? What are we not talking about? Now, there's going to be lots of different issues compiled on each other, but I think you need to separate as much as you can and say, this is what we're talking about. You need to choose the right time. 11:30 for me and Krista to start talking about our finances, not the right time. All right? There's even rules. We don't talk about this after this time. Also, when you choose the right time, we're thinking there about the processing speeds of different people. For myself, I'm wired for communication and let's get this done. The person that I've married, she's a processor. She needs time to think through something. And so that's what you're trying to figure out. Choose the right time, choose the right place, you know, at your in-laws, in front of other couples, Christmas morning, probably not the best time to bring it up. So choose the right time, choose the right place. Begin with a positive stroke. And I think that's so key. And before you bring it up, say, you know what? I want you to know how committed I am to this marriage. I want you to know how much I love you, how much I see God at work in your life, that you begin with a positive stroke, not in a contrite way, but in a very thoughtful way. You begin by saying how committed you are. Then stick to the issue, all right? Don't throw out a red herring. Well, yeah, well, what about this? Stick to the issue. Attack that problem, not the person. Do not bring up the past. If things have been forgiven, they need to stay there, which is hard. Yeah, well, what about 5, 10, 3 months ago, whatever it was? If things have been forgiven, it needs to stay there. Don't bring up the past. Don't hit below the belt. We all have issues, histories, experiences, traumas that trigger us. And in conflict situations, do not hit below the belt on those things. Especially when it comes to things like physical appearance or weight or things that we know would absolutely devastate the person that we are talking to, do not hit below the belt. The other one is take the other seriously. No ridiculing, no humor, sarcastic laughter, that sort of stuff. Express anger non-abusively. Do these things that I'm leading you through right now. Don't play games. Well, you always do that. Well, you never do that. Always and never are not good words in any type of relationship, because the truth is they probably always don't always say always, and they never always say no or never, never. You know what I'm saying? This is probably not true. And so these are games that we play. Other games are saying, well, I can never do anything right. Well, that's not actually a helpful way to work through the issue. Don't be passively aggressive. Indirect communication, silent treatment, forgetting or ignoring their existence. This is not helpful when we try to get into these situations. Avoid asking for explanations. What's wrong with you? Man, I don't know what's wrong with me. It's not helpful of behavior. Avoid labeling or name calling. This is obvious, but sometimes in the heat of the moment, we don't get it. Avoid labeling or name calling. Well, you're just like your mother. Right? Oh, that's not helpful. Well, of course you would do that because, right? Not helpful. You know, the song that we learned on the playground, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's absolutely wrong. Words hurt. So in these moments with the people that you love, rules for a fair fight, avoid labeling or name calling and avoid triangles. Not helpful. Yeah, well, I'm not the only one who thinks this. There's also this person and this person and this person. What you've done is you've triangled now the problem, and the person who's receiving that will no longer receive. Rules for a fair fight. How else do you do conflict well? Anger well, constructive conflict well. Get out, get outside help. Sometimes you absolutely need to ask for other people's opinion. This is a life group. This is a marriage mentor. This is a therapist. This is asking people, hey, we're stuck. We can't get out of this and we need some outside help. Somebody who's objective and loving enough to tell us the truth, to help us through this. And in an effort and in transparency, in an effort to kind of tear down any walls that may be hindering you from asking for outside help, I want to let you know that my wife and I right now are going through couples therapy. Somebody local here, they're helping us work through some patterns of communication that we're stuck in. We've been married for 12 years. Our marriage is not in crisis in any way, but it can be better. And our commitment to each other is to say, you know what? We need to work on this. So I just want to say that to hopefully tear down any walls that may be hindering you from asking for outside help. It's been enormously helpful for my wife and I. So get outside help. Okay, now, destructive conflict. That's the positive. This is the negative. What I want to do is I'm drawing on some work here from John Gottman again. Gottman is a researcher in relationships and really, really, really a leading thinker in this way. Gottman did what he called love labs, and he would get couples in, hundreds of couples in, to talk about their marriage and conflict and all that sort of stuff. What he did as a researcher is he saw and traced out the communication patterns that led to divorce. Okay, this is in a marriage context. Now, as I share these things, I'm not saying that if these are happening, that you're going to get divorced. That's not what I'm saying at all. It's the tone, the frequency, the ability to change, which will help these tendencies get better. So I'm not saying at all that this is what it leads to. Often I think these things I'm going to talk to you about are normal in relationships, but it's being aware of them and having to change them as well. So here's what Gottman said. When he looked at couples who got divorced, he called it the four horsemen, all right? The four horsemen. These were patterns of communication that led to destructive patterns in relationship. So the first one, oh, I should also say this. These also aren't linear, right? Sometimes we think it's like, okay, well, this happens and this happens and this happens. Gottman says, no, no, no. That these first three things, criticism, contempt, and defensiveness, is like a baton that's passed in communication, in conversations, okay? And if those three things don't change or get better, what ends up happening is the last one ends up happening, that's stonewalling. So think of this as baton passing, not linear. So let me just lead you through it. When we get into differences of opinion, when we feel feelings of anger or frustration or disappointment, here's what comes most naturally to us. The first thing is that we criticize. This is attacking someone's personality and character. What Gottman says is that there's a difference between a complaint and a criticism. A complaint sounds like this: hey, there's no gas in the car. I'm upset that you didn't fill it up like you said you would. Could you please deal with that tomorrow? That's just a complaint. Normal, right? Criticism sounds like this: why can't you remember anything? I told you 1,000 times to fill up the tank and you didn't. You're always so careless. And when complaints turn into criticism, and our criticism is a normal pattern of behavior and communication in times of differences of opinion, Gottman says that will disintegrate the intimacy, trust, and safety of that relationship, and in this case, marriage. So criticism is normal, but again, it's the frequency of the pattern that is scary. Now, criticism, Gottman says, leads to contempt, as he did this research. Contempt is an intent to insult or abuse. It's a sense of being superior over somebody else, right? Oh my goodness, again, you can't figure that out. What's wrong with you, right? That's contempt. Criticism leads to contempt. This is the second horseman. It's a form of disrespect. It conveys disgust at the other person. It's name calling, eye rolling, it's mocking, it's hostile humor. Well, I guess I've seen that before. You know where I saw that? I saw that in your dad. Boom, right? Whatever happens in those comments is destructive. I think it's a sense of pride. And I think it's a sense of, I am better than this person. If only they could be more like me, this wouldn't be a problem. Contempt sounds like this: You forgot to load the dishwasher again. You are so lazy, right? It's contempt. It's seething anger. This is what happens after long simmering thoughts, after unresolved conflict. That after the criticism piles up, the complaint is not dealt with, contempt will start to seep into the relationship, which leads to the third horseman. Remember, the baton passing. So this is all happening in one conversation, Gottman says. Defensiveness is this. It's victimizing yourself to ward off an attack and reverse the blame. It's not my fault we're going to be late. It's your fault, since you always get dressed at the last second. Right? It's attacking the person and not the problem. I've said this to you before, but we all have an inner lawyer. I have one. I employ him. And that's what defensiveness is when the issue comes up, we bring out this stack of evidence against that person and say, well, here is how you're wrong and how I am right. The problem isn't me. The problem is you. And let me tell you why. And why are you picking on me about this? Because I have example A, B, C, D, all the ways that I've gotten this right and you are wrong. What about all the good things I do? You are impossible to please. You know, when I think of my default in my key relationships, my marriage, just in general, my life is a defensiveness. And it's an insecurity that I have, that I want to be shown to be put together and successful and that I'm on top of everything. So when something is lobbed, especially in my marriage, I want to show Krista how wrong she is, how right I am. And I think that's going to be pave the way to closeness in my marriage. And it's just not true. It's not true. And so criticism leads to contempt, leads to defensiveness. And after long seasons of this, okay, this is like some of these things are normal, all right? We need to get out of them, but they're normal. After long, long seasons of this pattern, defensiveness, contempt, criticism, all going spiraling out of control, Gottman says eventually someone will shut down. And this is stonewalling. And stonewalling is withdrawing to avoid conflict and convey disapproval, distance, and separation. The person just shuts down and gets out. This looks like getting up and leaving the room in the middle of these types of conversation. We try to avoid the fight. We just don't want to talk about it again. So we try to avoid the fight. But in avoiding the fight or the conflict, we eventually just avoid the marriage altogether. There's no signs of conversational interest. And this is kind of the last step, that when all three are on repeat for long seasons, that this is the last step where they're stonewalling. It sounds like this. Look, you know what? I don't even know where to go from here. We've been over this repeatedly. You know where I stand. I'm done. That's stonewalling in relationships and in your marriage. So what I want to say, so when you look at those things, that defines you. It defines your relationship with your in-laws or with somebody at work. Defines your relationship with a sibling, with a child, with a grandchild. But these patterns just keep going and going and going and going, and it's so destructive. I also know that this is some of your marriages as well. Some of your lived realities right now where there's no communication. Stonewalling has happened on both sides and you're just cohabitating. And so I want to acknowledge the feeling and the pain that you're going through, that you're exasperated, you're unsure, you're confused, you're hurt. You don't know where to go from here. You're daydreaming of different realities. Man, my life would just be better if. In this lonely state, in this confused and hurt state, you're sending out tentacles of affection to other people. You're getting a hold of former relationships on Facebook, neighbors, trying to find another intimacy because it just is not found in this relationship. I just want to say it's very real and it's very difficult, and you are in a state of pain. There is hope. There is hope. So let me lead you through some ways towards reconciliation. I have three movements here through two different texts. Then we'll go to communion. The first movement is this. start with you. Start with you and Jesus. You cannot control the other person. You cannot control them rising out. You cannot control them getting help. You cannot control any of that. You can control you to take ownership of your own journey. And so Jesus, in Matthew chapter 5, says this: why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Why do you do that? See what he's saying? Objectively, there's only two specks, right? They're the same size. There's a speck in their eye and a speck in ours. But what we want to do is we want to maximize their speck to be a log, and we just see ours as nothing, right? Why do you do that? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own? You should, and what he's saying is, you should see the speck in your own eye as a plank and the speck in his eye as just a speck. It's a radical reframing to say, start with yourself before you criticize, before you attack. You need to start with you. Jesus goes on, you hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. And when we are in conflict moments, you need to ask, what of this do I need to own? You need to ask Jesus, what are you asking me to address in my character through this? Is it my unbridled anger, that in my anger I sin, and I sin a lot? Is it to ask for forgiveness for some of the patterns, the words that I have said in this relationship? Is it the fact that you need to own the home in which you grew up in and how that's affected your communication habits? And you need to go to therapy. You need to get outside help. My friends, you need to start with you. You cannot control the other person. That's the first movement. Start with you. Secondly, I want to lead us to John chapter 18. John chapter 18 is where we're going to go. John chapter 18 is the arrest of Jesus of Nazareth before he goes to the cross. For those of you who are new to church, this is what is going on. In John 18, here's what it says. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came, listen, to the garden with a detachment of soldiers and officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. This was the conflict-energized situation. It's night. It's in a garden. Judas, who betrays Jesus, comes with soldiers and with chief priests. They have weapons. They have lanterns. This is a highly energized conflict situation. Here's the interaction. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and they fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go." He's talking about his disciples who are now under arrest by these guards. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those who you gave me." Jesus, in the midst of this conflict, in the midst of betrayal from Judas, in the midst of the weapons that are drawn, he doesn't react in anger. What does he do? He gives himself to them. "I am Jesus of Nazareth. You've come for me." He doesn't run from this moment. Why? Because in the face of human betrayal, in the face of humanity approaching God to murder him, Jesus gives of himself. He knows that in order to solve the anger of the human heart, the betrayal, the brokenness, the strife, the contempt, the criticism, that he needs to die so that the human heart could be forgiven and rewired. And Jesus here in this moment gives himself over to Judas, over to these people who came at him with weapons. And he also allows his disciples to go. He says, let them go. Those, his disciples, Judas, these soldiers are the ones who should die. But Jesus here gives himself. And it's through his sacrificial giving of himself that peace is given to you. That as you start with yourself, as you look at the plank in your own eye, that leads us to Jesus to say, I need to be forgiven. I need to be rewired. I need to become a new creation because these patterns, these words, this situation needs to change. The second movement, as we think about ourselves, the second movement is to come to Jesus and ask him for peace as he has given himself for you and your anger and your destructive patterns of communication in sacrificial love. That's the second movement. The third one comes here in verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his ear. John says the servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? In Luke's account of this, it says that Jesus goes and heals the soldier's ear. Simon Peter, in an act of aggression, cuts the ear of one of the soldiers, ears off. He lashes out in anger and defensiveness. He thinks the way to get out of this situation is not in self-giving love, but rather in aggression and violence. And Jesus here condemns Peter's act of violence and heals his ear. And Jesus, here's the hope, the third movement, is that Jesus can restore what has been lost. He can restore what has happened because of that act of aggression. The first movement is start with you. The second one is as you start with you, come to Jesus. Ask for forgiveness. Ask that he would give you a new set of eyes, that you would become a new creation. And the third movement is this, is that Jesus can heal. He can come alongside you and the other person that you are in conflict with and bring reconciliation and healing as he did to the ear of Malchus. I also pray for courage, that people would come to you, would confess, would repent, would go to others in humility and ask for their forgiveness. They would reach out for help. They would look to these types of ways that they can do better as they move forward in their key relationships and in their marriage. So Jesus, I just know a healthy church has healthy relationships and healthy marriages. Do this, Lord, for our sake and for the sake of our church in our city. In your name I pray. Amen. Hey, thank you so much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.